It's Saturday, July the 5th, 2014. Kings Canyon National Park, California. The snow-covered tip of Mount Goddard soars high into the cloudless sky. A gust of wind whips up some of the powder. The crystals hang in the crisp mountain air, glimmering in the afternoon sun, before floating down the slope. Far below the summit, 33-year-old Greg Hine opens his eyes, regaining consciousness. For a second or two, he forgets where he is and what's happening, before reality hits him like a freight train. Suddenly, his senses fire and his vision focuses. He is falling down the mountainside on his back, skidding over the snow feet first. It's not a smooth descent either. He sinks into soft and slushy pockets, only then to hit patches of ice. The cold tears through his thin hiking top and burns the back of his arms.
Who knows how I end up on my back, but I wake up. I see a streak of red on the snow as I'm sliding down. I see it out of the corner of my eye, look back. I see my leg bent in a direction that I've never seen before, and I see my bone sticking out. As I come back to consciousness, things have drastically changed.
But there's no time to figure out what's happened. Looking down the slope, he sees a jumble of jagged rocks some 50 feet below. He's headed straight for them. Ever wondered what you would do when disaster strikes? If your life depended on your next decision, could you make the right choice? Welcome to Real Survival Stories. These are the astonishing tales of ordinary people thrown into extraordinary situations. People suddenly forced to fight for their lives. In this episode, we meet Greg Hine. After scaling California's Mount Goddard, an accident leaves him seriously injured at 4,000 meters. Things only get worse as he tumbles down the mountainside, hurtling towards the rocks below. Even if he can halt his descent, with a compound fracture in his tibia and a wound open to the elements, Greg's prospects are bleak. And this deep in the wilderness, he is totally on his own.
I broke down and was crying because my sister's birthday was a couple days, and I didn't want to add, you know, like more sadness to her birthday. That was the one point in the journey that I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it.
I'm John Hopkins from Noiser. This is Real Survival Stories. It's around 8 p.m. in California on July the 3rd, 2014. Greg is in the parking lot of Kings Canyon National Park. He sucks in the fresh mountain air and feels the stresses of daily life begin to melt away. This is his happy place.
I've been an outdoor kid my whole life. I just start bushwhacking, getting off trail and try to get lost ever since I was in my early teens. Being in the mountains and being outside has legitimately saved me. My outlook on life leading up to the Goddard trip was pretty positive. I feel like I've got a good bit of momentum, you know, pulling myself out of the depression and kind of things that the negativity of life that I've struggled with for most of my life, you know, the depression and lack of self-worth that I know that I've struggled with and spent a lot of time working on that now. So I was pretty excited. And just fundamentally, like, any trip to the backcountry is just, it's where it's at with me.
This trip marks a special occasion. Greg has just completed his college degree after a 10-year hiatus. To celebrate, his plan is to spend the next 4 days and nights trekking through the park via Blaney Hot Springs and Martha Lake. His main goal is to tackle the summit of Mount Goddard. Greg shoulders his pack. It contains water spare clothes, a sleeping bag, his bright yellow bivy bag, a multi-tool, a headlamp, his camera, and some dehydrated food. But before locking the car, he makes a fateful decision. He tosses his mobile phone onto the passenger seat. He's here to decompress after a tough semester. He wants to switch off. Besides, what good is a phone when there's next to no signal here anyway? It's nearly 8:30 p.m. when he finally gets going, though the darkened sky poses no problem. He snaps on his head torch and picks up the pace.
I don't want to say I'm skipping, but like, you know, I'm pretty excited. It was also 4th of July, 4th of July being a holiday in the U.S. I was like, well, you know, like everything coincides pretty nicely. I'm out here. I don't have to be around people. I don't, you know, like no fireworks. I'm just going to be enjoying myself. And so it was just, yeah, pretty amazing.
Greg starts up the iconic John Muir Trail. The trees quickly envelop him. He sticks to the path, breathing in the evergreen, woody fragrance. It's around 1 a.m. when he crosses the San Joaquin River and arrives at Blaney Hot Springs, where he intends to spend the night. The thermal spring is a large square pool in the middle of a meadow, like a natural hot tub. It's big enough for around 10 people. But tonight, Greg has it all to himself. Dumping his belongings, he submerges himself in the warm, mineral-rich water. Dragonflies buzz around, the silvery moonlight reflecting off their neon bodies. Overhead, the sky is a canopy of stars. The next morning is Friday the 4th of July, Independence Day. After crawling out of his sleeping bag and wolfing down a quick breakfast, Greg packs his gear and sets off. He sticks to the John Muir Trail for a couple of miles. Later that morning, he reaches a crossroads of sorts. He has to veer off the main trail and enter the park's wilderness area. Navigating is simple enough, though. He simply lines himself up with the peak of Mount Goddard. He's in no rush. Off the path, there are many wonders to discover.
It's all new, like, and the newness and the joy of it being new is like kind of drawing me forward, and it's like, oh, what's up next? What's around the bend? Or, you know, like kind of that mentality. I'm just walking and I'm like finding my way, and I'm still finding little waterfalls and little things to check out, and you know, like I'm zigging and zagging and just, what's there to see? Where, you know, like I'm just so present and just loving being in the mountains again.
Even with regular stops to take photos and identify wildflowers, Greg has racked up 20 miles and 3,000 feet of elevation by the time he reaches the shores of Martha Lake. As he beds down for the night, Mount Goddard glows in the setting sunlight. With any luck, he'll be standing on that very summit tomorrow. Hi, listeners. If you have an amazing survival story of your own that you'd like to put forward for the show, let us know. Drop us an email at support@noiser.com. That's support@noiser.com.
I'm historian Ruth Goodman, host of Noiser's newest podcast, The Curious History of Your Home. I've spent my life investigating the hidden history of everyday objects. The vacuum cleaner in your cupboard, sleek and compact today, but when it was invented, it was literally powered by horses and took 4 to 6 people to operate. The minty fresh toothpaste by a sink. Well, if you lived in ancient Greece, you'd be washing your teeth with ground up bones and oyster shells. Double glazed windows? We owe those to a French king's odd fascination with oranges. The Curious History of Your Home explores the extraordinary in the ordinary. Listen to The Curious History of Your Home each Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts. From award-winning podcasters Noiser, The Curious History of Your Home.
It's 2 p.m. on Saturday. Greg has been climbing for hours. The summit of Mount Goddard is now within reach, though the final part of the ascent is hard going. The incline is unforgiving, and the midsummer sun beats down. Greg grits his teeth and pushes on. With one final burst, he scrambles up to the top. He has made it.
I was like, oh, how amazing. I'm like so blessed. You know, like, how awesome is this?
The view from 13,500 feet is incredible. The jagged, snow-sprinkled ridgelines roll away in every direction. Here and there, shimmering alpine lakes catch the eye. Above it all, the azure sky. He whips out his camera to capture the moment.
I've taken pictures, and my buddy let me borrow his camera, who actually put me onto the idea of doing Mount Goddard. It was his idea to do the peak and turn me onto the peak. And I'm like, sweet, maybe if I take enough pictures, he'll be stoked enough to want to come out here and want to experience this too. I was always trying to get him out there for years, for decades. And like, this is awesome. Okay. I still got a lot of hiking to do.
Greg goes to sign the summit logbook. Apparently, not many people make it to the top. He's only the third person this year. With some satisfaction, he adds his name, like joining an exclusive club. Greg lingers for a while longer, but his attention soon turns to the descent awaiting him. He moves to the south side of the mountain, gazes down. The main slope is strewn with massive boulders, some as big as a house. Picking over these would not be ideal.
Walk on rocks long enough, they hurt your knees. Even if you have trekking poles, which you can't use trekking poles because your trekking poles just skitter off the rocks.
So he walks across to the top of the north face. Below is a series of channels or couloirs. One of them in particular looks manageable. Near the top, snow lies between the larger boulders, offering a possible route down. Beyond the boulders, there's a steep bank of smaller rocks, which gives way to a stretch of scree. He'll need to watch his footing, but it should be okay.
So there's this big question mark in my head as I'm hiking, and I'm unsure which way to go. So there's a bit of unknowing and uncertainty in the day. So, you know, I get down off the peak. It's probably mid-afternoon at this point.
Greg begins working his way down. The chute is a couple of miles long. After clambering over the larger boulders, he hits the section of packed slate and shale. Greg slows, taking extra care. He continually tests his footing before applying his full weight. Once or twice he sends rocks skittering down the mountain, but he's keeping his balance.
Take two steps, stop, look up, let everything flush out, like a rock avalanche, basically. So, I've got a safety protocol going through my head. You don't really need to look up first few times you do this because there's nothing above you, you know? Nothing that's going to come up except loose dirt. So just kind of look over your shoulder. And then as you get further down, you start looking up more. And so I'm descending and I'm literally two steps, one step, two step.
The stop-start nature of the descent is time-consuming and exhausting, but it's smart. Eventually, he makes it to the bottom of the scree without incident. He catches his breath on a small ledge. The rest of the slope below is covered in thick snow. Here and there, sharp rocks jut out like shark fins. At the bottom of the snowfield is another jumble of larger rocks. Greg considers sliding down on his backside. It could be simple enough. But then again, he has no way of knowing how deep the snow is. And were he to slide, how would he stop himself? He hesitates. No way back up. No easy way down.
I am unnerved a little bit. I feel like, why did I put myself in this position? I'm laboriously, like, kind of spread eagle, trying to get my balance, trying to pull out my trekking pole because I put it behind my back, both of them. And I'm like, what am I doing? Like, how am I gonna do this? I'm like awkward, I don't wanna fall back. I can't really turn and move very easily. And so I just kind of, I'm staying there too long. I'm just there too long.
From higher up the mountain, he hears something. A crunching, grating noise. He looks up. A large rock has come loose, about 2 feet by 3 feet, and it's rolling down the slope towards him.
I see this rock start sliding down the path that I had come down. I'm on a little bit of a ledge, and there's a straight drop-off before the snow hits, and I'm trying to suck my hips into the wall, hoping that this rock has enough inertia and momentum to basically fall past me, like fall over this little drop, and then hit the snow and avoid me altogether.
Greg presses his body against the side of the ledge. It's too narrow. He glances back up at the boulder tumbling towards him, then down at the snowy slope. Maybe he should jump. But then what? Again, he hesitates.
Now I've got this immediate danger of this rock, and the last thing I want to do is be between the rock that's sliding uncontrollably and me coming to the rocks, because I know I'm just going to be absolutely destroyed, or the worst case scenario is I'm going to be destroyed between the two rocks. I'm in a rock and a hard place, basically. And so I tried to avoid and suck myself in, and the rock just falls on the back of my calf, my right leg, and I immediately black out.
Greg is only unconscious for a second or two. But when he opens his eyes, he finds the world is now upside down. He's hurtling down the mountainside on his back, feet first, skidding over the snow.
Next thing I know, I see a streak of red on the snow as I'm sliding down. That's something different. Never seen that before. I see my leg bent in a direction that I've never seen before, and I see my bone sticking out.
He tries to raise the damaged leg into the air, out of the way of the snow, but he can't.
And as soon as I think about grabbing my leg, my foot dips into a snow cup. The bottom of my leg starts bouncing. And I'm like, that's not good. If that violent action happens again and I'm sliding down, it could rip my leg off, and then what am I gonna do?
But whatever the state of his leg, there's the small matter of those jagged rocks at the bottom, rushing up to meet him.
So I was able to grab my foot. And then from this point, it's like, okay, next situation, I've got to stop myself. So I dig my left heel in and I dig my left palm into the snow.
The cold burns his skin as Greg plunges his hand and his good foot deeper and deeper. Gradually, he slows, then comes to a stop just 6 feet shy of the rocks. Breathing heavily, still cradling his busted leg in his other hand, Greg looks around and tries to take stock. As a seasoned outdoorsman, he knows it's vital he doesn't panic.
As a whitewater rafting guide, I had taken first aid training along with the swiftwater rescue training, and I'd done that twice. But I definitely feel like, yeah, I can handle anything that comes up when I'm in the backcountry. The mantra comes into my head immediately. There's nothing you can do to make the situation better, but there are a whole heck of a lot of things you can do to mess it up and make it worse.
First things first, if he stays on the snow for too long, he risks hypothermia.
Get off the snow. You don't want to get wet. You don't want to get cold. Okay, get off the rocks. Put all your clothes on. Get warm. You might go into shock. Get the shoe off of your leg. It's hurting because it's weighing down your leg. Okay. Excruciating pain taking off the shoe. And now put on all of your clothes.
Greg empties his backpack, making a mental note of each item. Careful not to bump the bone protruding from his shin, he pulls on two pairs of fleece trousers and all three of his fleece shirts. But then he hears another sound from above.
I heard a rock fall in another chute, distant from myself. We cannot stay here. We have got to make a decision quickly to get out of here. I do not want another rock coming down the same area and hitting me or causing more damage.
Greg knows he can't carry his full pack. He starts ruthlessly discarding anything he can do without, even food and water.
I left my food, my water. I mean, because, you know, honestly, I'm not staying out here for 3 weeks. I'm not surviving for 3 weeks. I know that right away. So it doesn't matter if I have a couple days worth of food. I've got snow. I've got my poncho. I can melt the snow and get water that way.
Greg also dumps his sleeping bag and inflatable mattress. He can sleep in his bivy bag. He keeps the Leatherman multi-tool. In the worst case scenario, maybe he could amputate his own leg. He looks down. Despite the initial gush of blood, the bleeding actually seems okay now. Using his multi-tool, Greg cuts a section from his discarded mattress and wraps it tightly around his leg. Then uses his trekking pole and belt to fashion a splint. Given the situation, is an impressive feat of medical engineering. With his bag lightened and his leg strapped, he focuses on escaping the snowfield. About 100 feet below him is an earthen ridge, a raised mound of dirt and rock created by an ancient glacier. From there, he reasons, he should be in sight of some of the larger lakes where people fish. He'll be closer to the main trail, and perhaps even within earshot of passing hikers. Greg starts to slide across the snow with his splinted leg stretched out in front. Each movement is agony. It's late afternoon by the time he finally crawls up on top of the earth ridge. Greg unrolls his bivy and sets up a basic camp. Then he turns his attention back to his leg.
So I undid the straps on my leg, and without the support, the leg dangles, and the bones clack on each other, and there's nothing. That's just excruciating pain.
At least the blood flow has slowed to a trickle. His belt is acting as a tourniquet. Clearly, he needs to retain as much blood as possible. But if he stops the flow completely, he could lose the limb. So Greg decides to alternate how much pressure he keeps on his leg. If the blood flow speeds up, he can tighten the belt. If it remains at a trickle, he can keep it looser. Next, he considers his chances of rescue. It's Saturday. His dad isn't expecting him back until Monday evening. That means any rescue attempt probably wouldn't start until Tuesday at the earliest. That's 3 days away. The best thing he can do is sit tight to keep as close to Mount Goddard as possible. Presumably, that's where they'll look for him. From his vantage point, Greg can see for miles. He can glimpse the glassy surfaces of Wonder Lake to the east and Davis Lake to the north. He can't quite make out the trailhead, but it's there somewhere. If he can just catch someone's attention, maybe they could alert a ranger. Before he climbs into his bivy bag for the night, Greg clasps his emergency whistle between his lips and blasts 3 times. He has to try, at least. It's Sunday, 4 days since Greg set off on his solo trek. The sun rises, bathing the mountains in hues of orange and red. In the valley below, Wonder Lake is being whipped up by a strong breeze. After a fitful night, Greg has a long day ahead of him. A long day of staying put and hoping the wind carries his whistles for help.
I figured, you know, a couple days, blowing the whistle, someone's going to notify the backcountry ranger there. One way or the other, there's enough people hiking. Like, I relied on that for like comfort and I think security.
As the hours pass, periodically Greg loosens the belt strap to allow blood to circulate around his leg. He wiggles his toes.
I'm off and on, like, allow the leg to survive. I'm playing with my toes, making sure I still have movement in my foot, because if I lose movement in my foot, like, there are other issues to deal with. You know, like, I'm cognizant and aware that there's a deterioration that's probably going to take place.
It's late that afternoon, around 24 hours after the fall, that Greg's situation changes. He begins to notice something, a rancid smell. It's drifting up from under his makeshift dressing. Greg pulls off the material and is alarmed at what he sees.
Towards the end of the day, 5, 6 o'clock, I finally undid the thermarest around my leg and was like, what is that smell? And my leg had already gotten infected. So when the rock hit me, it bounced me into some dirt and pebbles, and those had gotten into the wound.
Thick pus coats the protruding bone. If untreated, this could lead to cellulitis, severe tissue damage, and gangrene. Worse, sepsis could set in. In some cases, it can take as little as 12 hours from the earliest signs of infection to catastrophic organ failure. It is vital he cleans the wound. Greg looks back at the snowfield above him, the same snowfield he climbed down yesterday. He knows what he has to do.
And I'm like, okay, I have to do this. I don't want to do this, but I have to crawl back to the snowfield.
Two hours later, Greg is back in the snow. He digs away the first few layers until he's looking at the sparkling, clean crystals beneath.
And so I scrape down to just white snow, and I scrunch the snow in my hands and then use it as a scouring pad. I'm scouring the wound. I'm scraping the blood and pus off the bone. As I lean forward to grab more snow, to crumple it up, to squeeze it into my hand, to kind of make it very icy and compact, my bones clack against each other, and you know, there's an excruciating amount of pain that accompanies this. And I clean it out as clean as I could get it, and it's kind of as much pain as I could endure that first go. I fill the wound with the snow and just let it melt.
As the sun sets, and with his wound flushed out as best he can, he makes his way slowly back down to camp. He's doing everything he can to improve his chances of survival. Monday, July the 7th. Greg makes another trip up to the snowfield. After scouring clean his wound once again and enduring the excruciating pain, he returns to his perch overlooking the lakes. He still has at least 24 hours before his dad, hopefully, reports him missing. Greg's plan of staying put and waiting for rescue is a smart one. It's what survival experts would tend to recommend. Still, it's hard to keep doubts from creeping in.
If you're injured or get lost, like, stay put, right? That's the golden rule of being lost or being injured, stay put. I'm like, yeah, it's the golden rule, but when you're this remote and you don't know if anybody's coming for you, and maybe a dozen people, some at the peak a year, like, no one's dropping the North Ridge of Goddard, you know? Like, we can count on that.
Greg has plenty of time to argue it back and forth, but eventually he returns to his mantra.
There's nothing you can do to make the situation better, but there are a whole heck of a lot of things you can do to mess it up and make it worse.
Tuesday, July the 8th. Greg spends another day tending to his wound, making his way back and forth to the snowfield. He's losing sensation in his leg now, and doubts continue to nag at him. He keeps a constant eye on the skies, but there's no sign of rescue. Instead, dark clouds gather overhead. Later that afternoon, the heavens open. Greg hauls on his bivy and poncho for protection.
That was a cold night. The coldest night for me. My leg kind of froze. It started aching in the middle of the night. And I didn't get any relief until the sun came out the next day and my leg warmed up. And I was like, well, the nerves or the leg is deteriorating. Like, this is something that I need to do something, right?
Greg still can't straighten his leg. He can't move his foot, and his toes are numb. The infection is clearly progressing rapidly. He decides he can stay put no longer. It's time to go.
I was like, oh, I should go. And then I was like, no, stay put. And I was like, no, like I got to rescue myself. Like this is the situation has turned now. And I've got to take this into my own hands again. Like I just can't sit here. So I was like, okay, what do I got to do to move?
It's mid-morning on Wednesday, July the 9th. Greg is on the move. Working his way down the foot of Mount Goddard, he's headed for Davis Lake, which lies in the basin below him. Shuffling miles over rocky terrain while keeping one hand on a broken leg might seem an impossible task. But Greg has devised an ingenious solution.
So I immobilized my leg. I cut a small hole in my socks and I cut the string off the top of my bivy sack so I could attach the sock to one of the two straps that held the trekking poles together so that it immobilized the leg even more and my foot wouldn't bounce every time I moved. I was like, oh, that was super clever. So like I got pumped. Like I was like, ah, I did something cool. Like, you know, like it worked. I start moving. Like I start really going fast. And I'm like, slow down. And I'm just like, I'm literally just enjoying moving again. And then I slip on a rock and catch myself like on my side. Luckily I didn't hit my leg. And I was like, dude, what's wrong with you? Like, slow down. Stop going so fast. And it goes through my head again. There's nothing you can do to make the situation better, but there's sure a whole lot you can do to mess it up.
Finally, Greg makes it to the bottom of the north face. But when he gets there, he sees just how much work is still ahead of him. At this point, he'd anticipated a smooth descent to the lake, but it's actually an undulating route.
Basically, you get to a point where it's like, okay, I'm doing 30 crawls and I'm going to stop. And then finally, just you turn around and go backwards. Do the same thing. Crawling, moving, scooching your butt. You know, lift up, scoot forward, and get down. You know, so it's up, move, down. Up, move, down. And my forearms have never been worked this hard or this intensely in my life. But I have a goal in mind, and I'm going to push through.
By mid-afternoon, Greg's halfway there. He takes a break at the bank of a smaller lake. His wound is covered in dust and grime and bits of gravel. He crawls to the edge on his blistered hands and looks at the cloudy water. Not exactly sterile, but he has no choice.
I need to clean out the wound, so I put some water in the wound just to irrigate it. I knew I was introducing biological material. You know, it is what it is. Like, I can't really do much. And because the wound needs to keep being cleaned out. In my eyes, that was more important.
His goal is within reach now. Less than a mile away, sunlight bounces off Davis Lake. Summoning all his energy, he sets off again. 20 scoots, break. 20 more scoots, another break. Taking a breather, Greg notices a cricket just ahead of him. He's barely eaten anything in 3 days. He darts out a hand. He removes the wings and back legs from the insect and pops it in his mouth. It tastes surprisingly good. As he continues on his way, he manages to catch another cricket, 10 large ants, 5 or 6 moths, and some unidentifiable water bugs. Right now, he needs every calorie he can get. Just as the sun is starting to set, Greg makes it to the shore of Davis Lake. He collapses by its side. The water feels cool and inviting against his hand. He should feel elated with his superhuman effort, but he doesn't. Instead, he's almost overwhelmed with something between guilt and despair.
I broke down for the first time. After crawling those 2 miles down to the lower lake, I broke down and was crying because my sister's birthday was a couple days, and I didn't want to add, you know, like more sadness to her birthday. that was the one point in the journey that I was like, I don't know if I'm going to make it.
Greg finds a spot in the thick tussock grass and beats it into a makeshift mattress. He lays his bivy bag on top and climbs in. Thursday, July the 10th. Greg wakes up feeling somewhat better. He's had a surprisingly decent night's kip. It's a beautiful day. In spite of everything, he can't help but savor his surroundings. The edge of the lake is lined with a particular flower that he's fond of, Jeffrey's shooting stars. Their long stems and brightly colored petals offer a timely reminder of why he came out here in the first place, to connect with nature. He lets the scent of the flowers and the sound of the water lapping at the bank wash over him. And then another sound, something strange. Greg sits up.
I hear the helicopter come buzzing over. It was on the, so, you know, I'm now in between Mount Goddard, which is 13,500 foot peak, and Mount McGee, which is 12,500 feet, or, you know, above 12,000. And I'm in between these and this high altitude helicopter. Their rescue helicopter comes buzzing over, and I'm like, they're out looking for me.
But instead of circling, the helicopter flies on towards Mount Goddard. He watches as it hovers over the crest of the mountain before swooping out of view. Silence descends. If Greg had just stayed where he was, they would have found him already. But the rescuers haven't given up that easily. Soon another chopper comes into view. This time, Greg has a plan. He shuffles over to a rock and holds himself upright, making himself as visible as possible.
So when it flew kind of back across the lake area where I was, I started waving my canary yellow bivy sack above my head in a circle to try to be seen.
But it's no good. Time and time again, the helicopters pass overhead without seeing him.
I am so exhausted from crawling down to the rock, standing up on the rock, pulling myself up on the rock, and in pain the whole time, and more pain from standing up and the throbbing of the leg, and then crawling back up after they leave, and then waiting for them to come back, moving and exertion and hope and despair. You start to understand. You can see them, but they can't see you. And you realize just how camouflaged and how challenging it is to be found. And then finally, towards mid-afternoon, I'm like, you know, the hell with this. If they come and they go, like, I'm just going to sit here and I'm going to fall asleep.
Exhausted, Greg lies back. He's out for the count almost immediately. But not for long, though. With bleary eyes, he glances up. There is a chopper right above him. He won't get a better chance than this. He grabs a handful of rocks. With the last of his energy, he hurls them into the air, trying desperately to make himself seen.
And then finally, I throw a rock and they like literally come horizontal to me. And I see two faces look at me. They were all in headsets and they said, there's somebody right there. And I stopped throwing rocks and I waved. And then you know you're found, which is a very beautiful feeling.
The helicopter lands. The pilots hurry over. Straight away, they start checking Greg's vital signs. They ask him if he's in much pain. Strangely enough, right now, he feels okay.
The brain is so powerful. But my brain turned off any sensation for food, any desire for thirst, and really, for the most part, decreased the amount of pain I endured throughout the whole time I was out there.
Having fended for himself for the past 5 days, Greg struggles to snap out of the survival mindset, even when the time comes to leave.
And then they're like, okay, we're gonna move you to the helicopter. And I'm like, no, I got this. Like, you guys are good. you guys go to the helicopter and I'll be there shortly, right? They're like, no, we got this. Like, we'll pick you up. And so they made a three-person linked arm chair for me basically to sit in and then carried me to the helicopter.
Greg is flown to the Community Regional Medical Center around 70 miles away in Fresno. He shares a tearful reunion with his family. In the operating room, surgeons reset the bones in his leg. In all, he will undergo 6 operations. Despite all he's been through, as he begins his recovery, Greg looks forward to hiking again as soon as his leg allows. He's learned some powerful lessons about his ability to survive, the importance of not panicking, even when staring at his own protruding tibia, of keeping a level head and making smart decisions to manage his wound, of staying in the open even after he moved from Mount Goddard to make sure he was visible from the skies.
There are always going to be challenging things that arise in our lives, but even like beyond hard things, death, you know, divorce, loss of a job, like there are beautiful things that occur because of the hard things. They don't happen in an isolation, and to be able to notice that and to be able to experience that and to acknowledge it. That desire and that drive to stay alive is so strong.
In the next episode, we meet guitarist Moss Hills. In August 1991, he and his wife Tracy are working as musicians on board a Greek ocean liner. It's their job to keep the passengers happy, whatever the weather. But when the vessel hits deadly seas and the power cuts out, the couple will find themselves responsible for a lot more than the guests' entertainment. As the order goes out to abandon ship, Moss and Tracy must step up to the plate. That's next time on Real Survival Stories. Listen to that episode today without waiting a week by subscribing to Noiser Plus.